subject, as has been said, is The Struggle for the Soul of Texas, Revival at Washington on the Brazos, 1841. Texas declared its independence from Mexico on the 2nd of March, 1836, as a free, sovereign, and independent republic. American settlers, flocking into its territory from the east, established their own state, not within the United States, but entirely separate. It lasted 10 years. It was eventually decided that the future of Texas lay with the United States, and an annexation followed in 1846. But over a decade before that, Texas was a crucible of experiment. What was the republic's future to be? This was a cultural question as well as a political question. What social, moral, intellectual forces should shape the life of this new land? There was a struggle for the soul of Texas. The place where Texas independence was declared was Washington on the Brazos. In 1841, halfway through the existence of this sovereign republic, there was a Baptist revival in that town. I want to suggest that this revival provides a key for understanding the cultural history of Texas in that period. Further, the episode reveals forces engaged in competition for the domination of the adjacent United States and indeed the whole of the English-speaking world around the middle of the 19th century. So through the microcosm of the revival at Washington on the Brazos, we can appreciate the macrocosm of the evolution of Anglophone culture in relation to the Christian gospel during the 19th century. Let's begin with the background. Washington stood on the Brazos River of central Texas, 254 miles north of its mouth, just west of Houston. The town was at the reputed head of navigation. Indeed, rather amusingly, in the year after revival, the first steamboat reached the town up the river, but plans for a regular service were abandoned after it sank on the return journey. The main route across the state from east to west passed through the town, which had a ferry from 1822. Therefore, the site was a potential communication center. It was located in the middle of an area of pleasant rolling countryside, replete with woods and water. Unlike the more arid prairies to the west, it attracted farmers. It produced corn, cotton, sugar. Yet in 1841, it was still very much on the frontier. The last buffalo to be killed in Washington County was not killed until 1850. This was a place where newcomers from the more settled southern states encountered the Wild West. The town was laid out in the 1830s by a speculative developer and named after Washington, Georgia. It was particularly popular because there were hopes that since the town was the birthplace of Texas independence, it would be named the capital. Yet the population was still very small. In 1840, the population of the area was said to be 600. And in 1841, the year of the revival itself, only just over 100 adults were in permanent residence in the town itself. Washington was a place of intermittently grand pretensions, but in reality, a tiny frontier settlement. A Baptist church was formed in the town in 1837. It included only 8 members, and some colourful characters, such as Noah T. Byers, general merchant, armourer to the troops that won Texas independence, and later a Baptist preacher, a man, I suspect, whose zeal sometimes outrun his judgment. The leader of the church was Zacharias N. Morrell, a man who had preached in Tennessee before he arrived in Texas in 1836, a man who was untrained and volatile, probably an abler Indian writer than minister of the gospel. The church started work on a meeting house and invited both the American Baptist Home and foreign missions to send a full-time minister. But while that request was under consideration, the church disintegrated. The Republic of Texas decided to locate its capital in Austin, not Washington, in 1839, and the people who had hoped to profit from the development of the town moved elsewhere in search of better fortunes. The church dissolved, though a handful of former members lived on in the town. However, three other Baptist churches were formed in the vicinity in 1839, one at Independence, only 12 miles down the road in Washington County. In the following year, three new churches were constituted as the Union Baptist Association, and so there were good prospects in the area. Therefore, the first representative of the American Baptist Home Missionary Society, James Huckins, who eventually arrived in Texas at the end of 1840, decided to send the second agent of the society to Washington County. This was William M. Tryon, who became joint pastor of Independence and determined to restart the cause of the town of Washington. The church there was reorganized in March 1841 with 12 members. It was agreed that Tryon should preach monthly, and he arranged a regular Sunday school. The church clerk, Anderson Buffington, one of the members of the earlier church and a licensed exhorter, was an ardent soul winner. And it was Buffington who was a leading spirit in a series of prayer meetings that were set up to pray for revival. The scene was set for a remarkable awakening. The revival can be outlined briefly before its wider significance is assessed. On Saturday, the 24th of July, 1841, the monthly meeting of the church was held. Tryon, the minister, brought with him a man of some eminence, known to people in this audience, Robert Emmett Bledsoe Baylor, Judge Baylor, a former member of the Houses of Representatives of Kentucky, Alabama, and the United States. Now a Texas judge, Baylor traveled around the state and preached as an ordained Baptist minister, whenever not dispensing justice. In fact, he occasionally got the two roles mixed up and addressed the congregation and said, "Now, members of the jury." He had helped Tryon start the church in Washington 4 months earlier. Buffington and his friends from the prayer meeting told the two ministers that they thought that the Lord would visit the church. Buffington preached in the afternoon, Tryon in the evening, but nothing in particular happened. On the Sunday morning, however, the temperature rose. A slave girl, accepted for church membership the previous day, was to be the first baptismal candidate of the new church. On the banks of the Brazos, Tryon lectured the people on believers' baptism, and then Baylor baptized the girl. Here was a public drama of baptism, which seems to have stirred the town. When Tryon preached that same evening, hearts were moved. Tryon had to depart to care for an ailing wife, and so Baylor led the evening prayer meeting, but there two actually professed conversion. Seeing hopes for an awakening were being realized, Buffington rode off on the following morning to bring back Tryon, so that on the Monday afternoon, Tryon preached to a crowded congregation, and a popular physician, Thomas Hard, expressed a personal faith. That evening, he and two converts from the previous day and another new convert were baptized in the Brazos by Tryon. At an after meeting, the account of the Philippian jailer relating to baptism was read from Acts 16. 10 citizens became anxious inquirers, and 3 of them professed conversion. On the Tuesday, Tryon felt compelled to leave for his wife's bedside, but Baylor remained and baptized another 4 candidates that night. The prayer meetings continued every evening that week, and there were further baptisms. Baylor concluded a remarkable series of meetings the following Sunday. It was a deeply stirring episode in the history of the young town. The revival was particularly striking in 3 respects. Firstly, it had made a major impression in terms of numbers. Overall, 31 or 32 professed conversion and 24 were baptized. Others were left for baptism later on, 6 being immersed on the 22nd of August. In the following year, the church reported 50 members. Now, these absolute numbers may not seem large, but they represent a huge impact on so small a place. Reports are unanimous that nearly every individual in the town was drawn to attend the services. More than half the adult citizens who had not previously made a profession of faith now did so. So the little town was transformed in the proportion of its active Christians. Secondly, the converts were commonly prominent figures. They included Thomas Hard, the physician I've mentioned, who owned 640 acres, four town lots, spent time on his calls with his patients, and therefore became popular. He was a very frequent witness to legal documents in the town. Robert A. Lott, who started taking a denominational newspaper that fall, was probably another convert. The 1840 census, he owned 496 acres, eight slaves, 16 workhorses, 75 cattle, and one stud. He also possessed a pleasure carriage, then a rarity in the town. A person who was baptized, though previously converted, was the wife of Henry R. Cartmell, a town businessman since 1840, who owned four lots and two grandfather clocks. We know that because the Texas census was peculiarly thorough. It had to be because they had to tax everything because the state was normally bankrupt. These were the folk who set the tone of Washington life. All the accounts stress that the respectable citizens were affected. Thirdly, the revival spread beyond Washington. Tryon and Baylor went on in August to preach at similar events nearby. At a place without a church, 8 miles up country, there were 21 conversions and 12 baptisms. Mount Gilead Baptist Church, about 25 miles away, there were 39 baptisms. The flame of the awakening, once kindled, readily burned over the adjacent area. The Washington revival, therefore, made a significant impact. But the stir caused by the revival can partly be explained by its atmosphere. As an old man in the 1870s, Judge Baylor recalled the events in which he'd played so prominent a part. He particularly remembered the baptisms after nightfall, the first ever performed at Washington. The proceedings started at the courtroom where the Declaration of Independence had been signed. That building also served as the Baptist place of worship. From there, the congregation marched in procession, singing hymns down the main street of the town to the River Brazos. Baylor had asked the candidates to dress in white and to wear white handkerchiefs round their heads. This was no doubt a practical measure to keep the hair under control in the water, but the whiteness of the handkerchief echoed the symbolism of the clothes. The candidates were being baptized into purity. A beautiful strand of white sand running out into the river reinforced that impression of whiteness, contrasting with the surrounding impenetrable darkness. There, recalled Baylor, we stood on the strand, not a cloud was to be seen in the heavens, and the silver moon with her train of brilliant stars threw their light down on this beautiful, touching, and solemn scene. The baptisms took place, the large crowd on the bank joined in the songs, and after the last one, Baylor continued, we stood silently for a moment to listen to that song, with its echoes as they died away in murmurs, down the Brazos de Dios. A 17-year-old youth, the son probably of one of the baptismal candidates, confirms the power of the event, speaking of the solemnity of the occasion, the hour of the night, the glittering of the moonbeams. And he added another element, the thought of the savages in the forest not far away. The danger from Native Americans, though receding, was still there. Noah T. Byers, former business partner, was to be killed by them 3 years later. The awareness of sinister powers lurking among the dark trees strengthened the sense of the contrast between light and darkness, good and evil. There is something here of the sensibility of Fenimore Cooper's Last of the Mohicans, published a few years earlier, about descriptions of the scene. Here, in reality at Washington, not in fiction, people were enacting great deeds in a grand, evocative landscape. They were creating something serene and noble in a wild country. They were molding a new Texas. What then were the rival elements competing with the Baptist revivalists to shape the young republic? There is a great deal of evidence from in and around the revival of the hostile forces in the field. First, there was the rough culture that flourished on the frontier. Washington contained a large transient population, birds of passage as they were called. Although generally respectful to the more permanent residents, they loved to prey on greenhorns newly arrived from the States, tricking the greenies, as they called them, into handing over their life savings was a favourite pastime. Many of these ne'er-do-wells were attracted by the horse racing regularly organised just south of the town. Their gambling, though technically illegal in the Republic, flourished openly. This section of the community loved whiskey and cards, spending much of their time in the two main bars of the town, especially the one run by John Rumsey, who, unlike the other, gave unlimited credit. Drink sometimes spawned violence, and it's noteworthy that the Methodist preacher who sometimes visited the Washington Bar to hold meetings wore pistols to preach. The streets of the town looked no different on Sunday from on any other day. The rough element loved to ridicule the pious. Knowing the Methodist minister's favourite hymn was "Blow Ye the Trumpet," one of the local ne'er-do-wells disturbed the service by blowing a steer horn outside. Pseudo-prayer meetings were held in a bar. They would sing imitation hymns, pass round bread and wine, and even copy the inflections of the Lord's Prayer on a violin. Z.N. Morell claimed that this type of mockery ended in the 1830s, but memories of it were fresh when Tryon arrived in the town. It was a type of satirical counter-theatre that sought to undermine religion by exposing it to ridicule. This was tacit recognition by the rough culture of the threat to its very existence posed by evangelicals such as Methodists and Baptists. One of those who wrote accounts of the revival at the time gave particular prominence to this form of popular irreligion at Washington. Joseph Huckins was the senior American Baptist Home Missionary Society agent in Texas, reporting regularly on progress to his employers. Huckins was a New Englander, born in New Hampshire in 1807, who was trying to recreate a New England community on the shores of Texas at Galveston. He was well educated, having trained at Brown University under Francis Wayland, leading Baptist intellectual of the day, and attended courses at Andover, the leading Congregational Theological Seminary, while Baptist minister in the town. He had served three New England churches altogether before enrolling in the Home Mission Society and being dispatched to explore the possibilities of a mission in Texas in 1839-40. Later, after 20 years serving in Galveston, he was to move to the prestigious pulpit of Wentworth Street Church in Charleston. To Texas observers, Huckins seemed too much the intellectual, always reading his sermons, engaging in argument in the pulpit, and weak in his gestures. It was his mission, he supposed, to bring greater refinement to the unpolished republic. On meeting Judge Baylor for the first time, for example, he looked the judge over and immediately ordered a new suit of clothes for him from a Houston merchant. From the flourishing port of Galveston, he wrote disdainfully of the area around Washington as the interior. His aim, as he put it, was to give system and order to the excitable and impulsive material which preponderates in this country. Huckins did not disapprove of revival as too expressive a form of religion. On the contrary, he warmly approved it, but he saw it as having a particular role. Revival was to civilize the natives. Hence, Huckins' account of events at Washington places great emphasis on the moral transformation of the town. He depicted the place before the revival in the darkest hues. "This town, I suppose," he wrote to a minister in New York, "has exceeded any town in the Republic for its wickedness. Gambling, drunkenness, murder, and every species of vice reign. This place," he wrote to the secretary of the Home Mission, "has been the high ground of Satan for years." But the revival, he wanted to insist, had effected a transformation. "Some of the most desperate men in the country," he wrote, "were there prostrate before God pleading for pardon. Where mock prayer meetings used to be held, real prayer meetings now took place. There had been, as he put it, a moral revolution." Now, his motive in this type of description is transparent. He's trying to show the supporters of the Texas missions in New York and New England that their efforts are worthwhile. Thus he wrote to the Home Mission Secretary about what he calls "your missionary labors" in Washington. It was what they were doing through their money that he had helped to raise on missionary tours back east. Revival, therefore, was vanquishing roughness, Huckins was stressing. To a remarkable degree, reality actually corresponded to the image projected by Huckins. Converts entered a Christian world with higher standards of behavior. The Union Baptist Association, to which Washington affiliated that same year, had rules of decorum. At its meetings, the appellation of brother, according to Article 12, shall be used in the association by members in all cases, no exceptions. Liquor, if at all, was to be used abstemiously. The association endorsed the formation of a temperance society, so that the stream of liquid fire which has desolated other countries may not blast and wither the rising prospects of this young and interesting republic. Tryon, 3 years later, was to urge the churches of the association, in similar words, to discountenance those broils and feuds which set law and government at defiance and are the blast and mildew of our country. Instead, church members were to disseminate the examples of forbearance. His own church at Washington led the way. It's true that not all the converts remained faithful. 5 years after the revival, membership was down from 50 to 36. Yet it was remembered that after the revival, Washington was never as wild as before. It seemed a suitable place to which to transfer the seat of government of Texas in the following year. The reasons for Sam Houston's decision to move the capital back from Austin to Washington were many. He wanted the administration to be less exposed to Indian and Mexican attack. And intriguingly, whereas the town of Houston required rent for accommodating the government's offices, Washington was willing to make its provision to the bankrupt state entirely free. That was a considerable inducement. But another reason was more personal. The sister of Houston's second wife, Margaret, was Antoinette Bledsoe, a devoted member of the Baptist Church at Washington, who must have reported on the transformation wrought in the town by the revival to her sister. And the lead in Washington's invitation to transfer the capital there was John Lockhart, almost certainly one of the prominent revival converts. So Houston, who was himself to be baptized in 1854, must have been swayed by the knowledge that Washington was now a much more respectable place, suitable for a seat of government. The revival of 1841 marked an epoch in the life of the town. The rough culture was disciplined. A second hostile force threatening the new Texas, alongside the rough culture, however, was not a symptom of social laxity, but a feature of intellectual life. What was called infidelity at the time, or often by its advocates, free thought, was widespread. This didn't always mean atheism. Indeed, more common was deism, the acknowledgement that there is a God who has created the world, but allied to that supposition the belief that he takes no further interest in it. Deists denied the doctrines of providence, the conviction that the Almighty cares for the world he brought into being, and of revelation, the belief that God made known his will and purpose supremely through the Bible. Deism was a typical belief of the secular enlightenment of the 18th century, professed, for example, by Voltaire, and had been embraced in some form by many of the founding fathers of the United States, including Thomas Jefferson. Usually containing a strain of anti-clericalism, deism seemed to many a natural accompaniment of republicanism, a repudiation of autocracy in the universe, just as republicanism was a repudiation of autocracy in the state. Several deists lived in Washington on the Brazos. It was one of the achievements of the Washington Revival to bring some of them to full-blooded Christian allegiance. Among the converts were several so-called leaders in infidelity. Three of them actually spoke during the revival. They publicly warned sinners of the great danger of their fighting against the King of Kings. Unbelievers, the converts urged, should cease their rebellion and accept the king's terms of mercy, accepting the monarch of the universe once more. Free thought, therefore, was a live intellectual alternative to Christian belief in early Texas. The most striking instance of a freethinker converted at Washington in 1841 was William H. Ewing. Possessing an extensive acreage for military service in the Texas Revolution, Ewing was living in Washington in 1837, by 1837, and acted as a local judge. Deafness, however, forced him to give up the practice of the law, and instead he turned to teaching in the town. I'm not quite sure why that should be easier for a deaf person, but there we are. Like many small-town teachers, Ewing was something of an autodidact. He read widely and took a special interest in deism, devouring every book he could find on the subject over 20 years and accepting its leading principles. Hearing of the scheme of the Baptists to hold a public immersion on the banks of the River Brazos on the first Sunday of the revival, he attended in pugnacious mood. He seems to have been specially incensed that the baptismal candidate was a black slave. Perhaps Ewing thought her insufficiently educated to make any commitment to Christian belief. Standing on the banks of the Brazos, he denounced the whole event. Immediately afterwards, however, he appears to have felt remorse for his action, and he started to consider whether perhaps those involved in the baptism were in the right after all. He no doubt attended the second baptismal ceremony on the Monday evening because, as he put it, the baptizing at night was a sight which called forth holier and more sublime feelings than I ever expect to experience again. By Tuesday, he joined in the revival service as a seeker of mercy, and by the end of the evening, he embraced a personal faith in Christ. Ewing described the awakening for the press in rapt terms. He had heard of no greater revival, he confessed, save on the day of Pentecost. There was still a trace of deistic language in his account of it. He wrote of happy beings offering praise to him who is worthy of all adoration, which would have been recognizable to deists. But there was no doubt of his sincere Christian faith. At the meeting of the Baptist Association in October, he'd several times testified to what God had done for him. In the following February, he was licensed as an exhorter and preached at Washington. Ewing, in fact, was the prize convert of the Washington revival. Both before and after his conversion, Ewing was eager to advance the cause of civilization. In the years before 1841, he'd conceived it as the spread of rational knowledge, free from all taint of superstition. That was no doubt the ideal he set before him when, in 1838, he was preparing a printing press in Washington with all its appurtenances. He planned to print a regular newspaper, but the plan didn't come to fruition, probably because of the dispersal of the town's population that soon followed. This scheme for promoting the values of the secular Enlightenment came to nothing. The most enterprising Baptist in the town, however, Anderson Buffington, bought the press from Ewing and, in partnership with Foster Brigham, started a newspaper called The Tarantula, probably because they inhabited the banks of the Brazos, which are rather dangerous. Published weekly on a Saturday, the newspaper was launched in March 1841, the same month as the Baptist Church. The initial issue transcribed the minutes of the first meeting of the Baptist Association to be really exciting and rivet the readership, and in an editorial appealed to Robert Howell, minister of the First Baptist Church in Nashville, to send books and hymn books. A Baptist library, it remarked, is much needed in this country. Hear, hear. The newspaper's devotion to Baptist affairs during the spring of 1841 must have been one of the causes preparing the public mind for the revival that followed. But the Tarantula operated in desperately difficult conditions. So scarce was paper for printing that Buffington went round the town from door to door collecting blank leaves from children's spelling books to turn into a newspaper. The newspaper was also short of subscribers. Buffington dropped out of its management in October 1841 and came to an early end in the following year. But for a while, the Tarantula tried to promote a very different formula from that which Ewing had projected. Whereas Ewing in his unregenerate days had envisaged the press as an organ of secular progress, Buffington saw its enlightening role as bound up with the cause of religion. For Buffington, faith and book learning belonged together. After his conversion, Ewing came to look at things in a similar light. By 1845, he was publishing another newspaper himself, The Lone Star and Southern Watchman. And he'd already stated his new ideal in 1841. In the revival, civilization had taken religion as an helpmate, as he put it. the cause of civilizing Texas would be helped rather than hindered by true religion. Faith would not subvert reason, but reinforce it. Free thought, we may conclude, was vanquished by the revival. The third competing force for the soul of Texas was admittedly a weaker one. It was, however, potentially serious for energetic Baptists such as Huckins and Tryon, for it was an internal grouping in the denomination that threatened to divide and neutralize its efforts. It consisted of the so-called anti-missionary Baptists, often later called primitive Baptists. The first anti-missionaries were high Calvinists who emphasized divine sovereignty. They did not object to the standard preaching of the gospel, because that was a God-ordained instrument of his purposes, but they did object to newfangled agencies such as the American Baptist Home Mission. The anti-missionaries were concerned for their pockets. It was serious for them that such bodies as the Home Mission were constantly demanding money from members of churches. But the fundamental anti-missionary case was that there was no scripture warrant for such organizations. These new societies purported to do what the Almighty could achieve by his own agency, the gathering of the elect. The anti-missionaries therefore resisted any support for the societies, whether for mission or for education. There was more than a hint of anti-intellectualism about their objections. Modern learning, they held, was a snare and could divert the believer from the simple message of the Bible. In the vicinity of Washington, there were several such anti-missionary preachers. One was Abner Smith, founder of the Providence Baptist Church in 1834. In 1840, he refused to join the newly founded Union Baptist Association. The reason that he gave is fascinating. He said he was not a United Baptist. He claimed to be a regular disunited Baptist. Such men believed, with some reason, that they represented the traditional Baptist convictions of their forefathers. Anti-missionary Baptists were uncompromising defenders of ancient ways. Baptists such as Huckins and Tryon, the so-called missionary Baptists by contrast, welcomed modern thought. They broadly upheld the principles of the New England theology that had emerged among the successors of Jonathan Edwards in Congregationalism, softening the sharper edges of traditional Calvinism. The Baptist who best represented their point of view was Andrew Fuller, the English minister who was the first secretary of the Baptist Missionary Society. To Judge Baylor, for example, Fuller was a great and good man. Fullerism was still Calvinistic in upholding the sovereignty of God in electing to salvation, but it held that if sinners ultimately perished, it was their own fault. Fullerites rejected the doctrine of double predestination, the belief that God was himself responsible for consigning the unsaved to perdition, and that is why they're usually styled moderate Calvinists. And they were equally moderate in accepting the pragmatic temper of the times. Techniques not set out in the Bible could be employed in achieving the great aim of spreading the gospel. Thus, there could be societies for missions and education. These were the means that the Almighty used to exercise his sovereignty. This moderate spirit, this pragmatic temper, was a sign that these Baptists had come to terms with the Enlightenment. They were prepared to modify their principles in the light of contemporary knowledge. Unlike the advocates of the secular Enlightenment, however, they were not abandoning the Bible. But they were presenting the teachings of Scripture in a form more palatable to an enlightened age. From the start, the Union Baptist Association adopted Fullerite principles. Article 7 contended that when sinners were not saved, it was because of their voluntary rejection of the gospel. So Washington, the churches with which it identified, was of the more modern persuasion. They were missionary Baptists identifying with a moderate Enlightenment temper. One advocate of their views was James L. Farquhar, a man concerned to ensure that missionary Baptists triumphed over their anti-missionary contemporaries. Farquhar was the sole deacon of the Washington Church at the time of the revival. He was 34 years old, originally from North Carolina and then from Mississippi. In 1840, he decided to seek his fortune in Texas, settling 4 miles from Washington on the road to independence. He owned 640 acres, and his wife, Huldah, was the owner in her own right of 15 slaves brought from Mississippi. In the first year, he planted about 20 acres of cotton, which turned out to be of very high quality. A visitor reported that he considered the cotton land superior to any in Mississippi or Florida, and equal probably to any in the world. Farquhar was, in fact, an enthusiastic patriot for his adopted land. He was full of pride for our country and the infant republic, as he wrote of it. He claimed to know nowhere where as good attention was paid to sermons as in Washington on the Brazos. So Farquhar was eager that the new nation should adopt the right outlook. That outlook was the Fullerite paradigm. Accordingly, in his account of the revival, Farquhar stresses some of the themes of moderate Calvinistic theology. Centrally, he contended that the Almighty was a God of means. The Lord certainly possessed all power in heaven and earth, as the anti-missionaries insisted, but he didn't mean that believers were to leave the spread of the gospel to divine providence. On the contrary, unless means were used, very little good would be done. One means was able preachers. Farquhar wrote of Tryon as someone sent by the Lord, an instrument in his hands. Another means was prayer. Farquhar drew attention to the prayer meetings, seeking an outpouring of the Holy Spirit that preceded the revival. Through prayer, Farquhar believed the gospel would spread throughout the globe. And like Jonathan Edwards, he looked for the salvation of the whole earth. He was, in fact, a post-millennial optimist, expecting the universal triumph of the Redeemer. The revival at Washington was evidence for him that God was fulfilling his promises and blessing the use of means. Farquhar was recognized by his contemporaries as being well-versed in theology. The association placed him on its committee over the Articles of Faith in 1842. But the principles of Fuller, he believed, were those that would confute the anti-missionaries. May the Lord convince them, he wrote in his report of the revival, of their error in opposing the spread of the gospel. He was deploying the awakening as a vindication of missionary Baptist convictions. Those convictions had to be articulated by a well-educated ministry. Farquhar had been dismayed at the time of the foundation of the Washington Church that Tryon, a properly qualified minister, could preach there only once a month. That he regarded as unfavorable circumstances, which made the revival all the more remarkable. So Farquhar was one of those who saw the supply of trained men as an urgent requirement. He fully backed the creation of a Texas Home Missionary Society to send out missionaries. It sent out Anderson Buffington. But Buffington had received no formal theological training, and both Farquhar and Tryon saw that as essential. Tryon believed that the first attempt at a Washington church in the 1830s had failed, partly because its leader, Z.N. Morrell, was an unpolished frontiersman. It was Tryon, therefore, who first suggested the idea of a Baptist literary institution in Texas. At the association meeting in October 1841, encouraged by news of the revival, it set up for the first time a Texas Baptist Education Society with the aim of creating an academical and theological institution. The result, after a stage of money-raising and petitioning the Texas Congress, was the establishment in 1845 of an institution known as Baylor University, named after the judge who conducted the revival. Its first instructor, Henry Flavel Gillette, was an Episcopalian whom Farquhar had induced to come to Washington to open a school in the summer of 1841, immediately after the revival. Education had to follow revival. The institution, therefore, was an embodiment of the victory of the missionary Baptists over the anti-missionaries in Texas. On the one hand, it provided the education that the anti-missionaries thought superfluous or dangerous. On the other, it was sponsored by a society, a non-ecclesiastical agency, that the missionaries considered unbiblical and subversive. Baylor University, therefore, represents the acceptance of the modern use of means in a way acceptable to the Enlightenment as the fruit of the revival at Washington in 1841. The fourth element in the competition for cultural hegemony in Texas was Campbellism. Alexander Campbell, after whom the movement was named, was an Ulsterman who had come to America and associated with Baptists, but who had gradually adopted distinctive principles. Campbell believed that the task of the age was the restoration of the pattern of the primitive church. The New Testament was a sort of law book. If its principles of church order were fully followed, Christians need not be divided by any theology derived from human learning. The Campbellites habitually appealed to reason, holding debates with freethinkers. They deplored any requirements for religious experience that might cloud the intellect. The Campbellites can rightly be seen as taking the acceptance of the Enlightenment much further than the Fullerites among the Baptists. Campbellites held that true religion consisted solely in mental assent, not in personal faith. Thus, they would baptize anyone willing to profess that Christ is the Son of God without any explanation of whether or not that person had passed through a conversion experience. Theirs was a religion of the head, not of the heart. This radical Enlightenment perspective on Christianity was propagated by Campbell through his magazine, The Millennial Harbinger. It circulated widely among Baptists, from whom Campbellites were not yet wholly divorced. Only gradually did they emerge as a separate denomination, turning into the Disciples or Churches of Christ. Meanwhile, Campbellite views posed a challenge to many Baptist churches. This outlook started making inroads into Washington County in around 1840, the year before the revival. Near LaGrange in Fayette County, just to the south, a Campbellite church was set up. And at LaGrange, there was also a Baptist church, and its minister, Thomas W. Cox, was soon persuaded to adopt Campbellite views. Another of the three churches served by Cox was Independence in Washington County itself. There, a deacon, Dr. John J. Clow, who also embraced Campbell's views, early in 1841 immersed a Washington schoolmaster called Rucker. This was a double affront to Baptist practice. The baptism should have been undertaken by an ordained minister, and the candidate was not required to relate his experience of coming to salvation before he was baptized. William Tryon, who became pastor in Washington in March 1841, had also been appointed co-pastor at Independence. In the same month, therefore, of this baptism, he preached against the act of Clow, and the church resolved that Rucker's baptism was invalid. Tryon, therefore, was setting his face against Campbellite teaching and practice. He must have feared that the same views would soon outcrop at Washington. Tryon was well fitted to resist a theological and pastoral challenge. Born in 1809, he'd been a protege of Charles D. Mallory, minister of the First Baptist Church in Atlanta. Mallory had encouraged Tryon to become one of the first students to pass through Mercer Institution to gain academic credentials in theology. Subsequently, Tryon had served the Georgia Baptist Convention, raising funds for mission and education in the manner of a missionary Baptist. Having met James Huckins, he volunteered for pioneer service in Texas with the Home Mission. So Tryon was a man of experience when he came to live halfway between Washington and Independence. His style also fitted him for an encounter with the Campbellites. Although his Bible knowledge was not thought to be equal to that of other preachers, he had a gift of presenting old truths in a fresh light. He was capable of reasoning in the pulpit, habitually putting the middle finger and thumb of his right hand up to make a cogent point. But he also probed the conscience in his sermons, exhorting his congregations powerfully. Judge Baylor remembered that he made solemn appeals to the sinner and caused him to feel as if the doom of eternity hung upon the choice he was about to make. He could deploy pathos and sometimes wept in the pulpit. So Tryon combined reason and emotion. He could meet the Campbellites on the field of reason, but unlike them, he believed that religious experience was the kernel of religion. Tryon's perspective is evident in his conduct of the revival. He wanted to generate not just intellectual conviction, but personal commitment. After his preaching had affected the congregation, an invitation, as he put it, was given to those who desired the prayers of God's people. Members of the congregation who were anxious to seek salvation had to indicate their condition by raising a hand so that believers could intercede for them. There was also a mourner's bench at the front where those wanting prayer to be focused on them for salvation could go. This element was much in the style of Charles Finney, whose lectures on revival of religion of 1835 had recommended this special measure. Tryon emphasized in his account of the awakening the deep feeling and streaming eyes. He particularly reports a very respectable citizen saying to him afterwards, "This is the first religious meeting at which I ever wept." In a similar way, Baylor, who carried on the revival after Tryon, was known for his willingness to shed tears in the pulpit. His favorite sermon, in fact, was on the text, "Jesus wept." Those responsible for the Washington revival were not afraid of emotion. Their conception of religion was that it was a matter of the heart as well as of the head. The struggle with the Campbellites in the locality came to a climax in the immediate aftermath of the revival. The association meeting in October 1841 was held under the auspices of the LaGrange Church. Its minister, Thomas Cox, now a Campbellite, used the opportunity to invite people to become candidates for baptism. They were merely asked three questions about their intellectual opinions, and the question of experience was ignored. Huckins protested, but Cox responded that this was an affair of the church alone. As it happened, news that Cox had been involved in shady business dealings in Alabama turned up at this point, and so he was excluded for reasons unrelated to the theological question. Very convenient. But the other two churches where Cox was minister suffered disruption. They were split down the middle, half becoming Campbellites, half remaining missionary Baptists. Washington itself had no similar experience of schism, partly because the two leaders, Buffington and Henry R. Cartmore, had been at Nashville, Tennessee, when a battle was fought there in the First Baptist Church against Campbellite entryists. They knew what to resist. But the absence of schism at Washington was also partly a result of the revival. When religious emotion was so obviously manifest and effective, it was hard not to see personal experience as a necessary qualification for baptism. The revival, therefore, played its part in resisting the challenge of the Campbellites. The radical enlightenment in religious guise was contained. So to draw the threads together. The awakening at Washington on the Brazos in 1841 was near the heart of the cultural strife over the future destiny of Texas. Because the Republic was marked by frontier conditions, a rough culture loomed large. Most weighty citizens, however, believed that the young country must be civilized. A central question was how far there should be an influx of Enlightenment influences that pervaded the English-speaking world. According to the free thinkers, the solution was the secular Enlightenment with its exclusion of revealed religion. But Christian people were not content with that solution. They differed among themselves, however, about how far to allow religion to be affected by the rational currents associated with the Enlightenment. The anti-missionary Baptists were stalwart in their views. There must be no watering down of high Calvinism and no compromise with newfangled societies. There must be resistance to the Enlightenment. The Campbellites, on the other hand, wanted to apply rationality more deeply to religion and so to adopt a radical Enlightenment form of Christianity. Each of these forces, however, went down before the missionary Baptists. They claimed Washington on the Brazos for the blending of Christianity with Enlightenment influences, but only in a moderate form. The missionary Baptists won the battle against roughness, the secular Enlightenment, resistance to Enlightenment, and the radical Enlightenment. The future of Texas lay with the position championed by the missionary Baptists, a recognizably modern evangelical stance. In the year before the revival, Judge Baylor wrote of the potential of the young and beautiful Republic. "If we," he went on, "as instruments in the hands of Providence, shall be enabled to give the moral and intellectual elements of society here a happy direction, whilst this country is in its infancy, Unborn millions will rise up and call us blessed. The awakening gave Baylor, Tryon, and their colleagues the opportunity to do exactly that. The Washington Revival of 1841 was a pivotal missionary Baptist victory in the struggle for the soul of Texas. Thank you very much.